The more I get to know Tony and his family, the more I love him and his family. Tony is a young theologian. He's a preacher. He was a youth pastor. He's a speaker, podcaster, author, expert movie reviewer. That is a big one. With Tony over the years, and we've had coffee and lunch, and I've read his book, and it's been a long time since I wanted him to come and share. And so, Tony, come and share with us this morning. We're excited to have you.
Thank you. Okay, let me get this. Is it on there? Okay, hi. How is everybody doing this morning? Good. Thank you so much for having me. Just a couple things that I wanted to share right at the get-go is I wanted to introduce everybody to my wife, Kelsey. You already met her. She's the lady with the angel voice up there that was singing. I am also, I don't think there's much to add other than what John said. One thing to add to the list is I am a John Hanna fanboy, though. I think John is a really, really good dude, and I could tell by talking with people in your church, Pastor John, that like you love and serve your community really, really well. And just so you guys know, he is somebody who has taken time to love and serve other leaders and pastors in the area, and has just been a really important voice in my life. So I'm excited to be able to be here and share with you guys, and it's an honor for me. I'm going to pray real quick. If you're able to, one more time, stand up and Just out of conviction and reverence, and if you can, place your hands out in front of you like this, just a posture of receiving from the Lord what He might say to us this morning, and we're going to dive in. Jesus, I thank you. I just so confess my need for you to speak this morning, to deliver something more important than what I have to say. That your spirit would be do what it does best and would just dive deep into our souls and release a new word, bring freshness, bring life this morning. We just ask all these things in your name. Amen. Amen. So I want to invite you guys on a journey with me all the way back, way, 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 way back to 2020, beginning of 2020. This was at this point in my life, like I had just a little bit about me. I had battled for a long time with a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety. And by early 2020, I was finally kind of getting a hold on some of those things. And so I was really tethering myself to Jesus and trying to get really good at spending time with Him and practicing different spiritual practices like Pastor John just talked about. So spending time just alone and sitting in His presence and reading the Word more and memorizing Scripture. But I was also doing other things to try and get my stuff in order. So like I was exercising more and I was going to counseling and I was doing well. Like at the beginning of 2020, like I felt like I finally kind of got a handle on my stuff. And then in January of 2020, I was a youth pastor at the time. I was sleeping, and one morning I get woken up to somebody banging on my door, and I get news that my lead pastor at the church that I was youth pastoring at had died unexpectedly of a heart attack. And so myself and another person on staff were asked to help oversee things in the church during that transition while our denomination, Foursquare, I'm a Foursquare pastor, looked for a new pastor. So I was, it was awful, and I was grieving it, and it was painful, but I was still kind of keeping on top of stuff. Like, I was still sticking with my disciplines, I was still going to counseling, still going to the gym, still, like, trying to, like, keep my stuff in line, and I knew, like, at that point, I needed it more than ever, because, like, now, rather than just overseeing a youth group, I was helping oversee the entire church. And then March of 2020 came, and my wife and I were on vacation in Bend, and the world was one way when we left for Bend, and we came back, and it was an entirely different world when we came back. And like that Monday, our first Monday back, we were going to our offices and bringing stuff home to work from home, and it was, you remember the classic line, it's just for a couple weeks, that was adorable. Like we thought that like, okay, this is going to be 2 weeks, and we can buckle through it, and at first, like, it was fine. Like, Kelsey made bread, and like, she'd never made bread before, and so like, we did that, and like, I finished working on my book, and We went through like binging all the Disney movies like in the order that they were released, and we did Zoom board game nights, and I also like have to be honest, like my introvert was in Nirvana. Like nobody could ask me to hang out, like nobody was allowed to like, and if they did, I got to make them feel so bad, like don't you care that lives are on the line? Like how dare you ask me to hang out? Like it was great. Like I just got to be at home alone and read. And but then 2 weeks turned into months, and people started developing totally sane and rational theories about what was going on in the world. The COVID death toll started piling up. Then a racial reckoning unlike anything I had seen in my lifetime started happening. Then polarization with an election started happening. And then the people in the church that I was overseeing went absolutely insane. Not everybody, but a lot of them went absolute bonkers. I think a lot of us went bonkers during that time. Oh, and then, I don't know if you remember, but Springfield almost burnt to the ground. If you remember that time, like there was fires coming in, and all of this time we still didn't have a lead pastor, and because, for a lot of reasons, it's hard to hire somebody during COVID. And slowly but surely during that time and that season, these disciplines that I had held on to so tightly of being with Jesus and reading scripture and worshiping and praying and exercising and going to counseling and all of this stuff, it started slowly and slowly going away, and it started being replaced with other things. Started being replaced with YouTube and movies and naps and binging shows on Netflix. And more than anything, that season was replaced with me just scrolling mindlessly for hours on end on my cell phone. You guys get that screen time report on your phone? Does anybody get that dreaded, like, and it makes you feel awful about your life? Like, you see it's like 4 hours, average 4 hours a day. So I was like watching this every single week, watching my screen time report go from like average of 2 hours a day, average of 4 hours a day. At one point, it went to average 7 hours a day of me just like sitting at home, just scrolling on my phone. And I noticed that like I started spiraling back into that anxiety, back into that depression, back into an old way of being and thinking that was no longer tethered to hope. And the craziest thing is that even though during this whole time, like I was totally disengaged, like I was forcing myself not to pay attention to kind of the more brutal realities of the moment. Even though that was happening, I was more restless and anxious and exhausted than I ever remember being in my entire life, just by distracting myself completely. And I was far from alone. So while in our country, we had really startling statistics when it came to mental health before COVID, those startling statistics went on to become a full-on epidemic during COVID. When COVID happened, more people reported to being depressed, more people reported to becoming addicted to substances, more people reported to attempting suicide than at any other point in the last 10 years during lockdown. One columnist reported that domestic abuse crisis hotlines received 33 to 40% more calls during COVID than they had ever experienced before. Deaths of despair skyrocketed during lockdown. A death of despair is when somebody dies as a coping mechanism of something they use to deal with the despair they're feeling. So this is drug overdoses or dying of liver failure from alcoholism or just suicide. And in the post-lockdown world, now that we are in this moment, the mental health statistics are hardly an improvement from what they used to be. And all of this misery, I think, reveals something about our culture. All of this collective misery, even though we've never had more money as a culture, even though we've never been more technologically and medically advanced as a culture, all of this stuff reveals that our culture does not have the resources to keep us happy, healthy, joyful, and strong during times of crisis. My misery during lockdown came as a direct result of me no longer taking on the way of Jesus and me taking the way of Jesus and surrendering it for the ways of culture, the ways of coping that the world offers. Our world offers us entertainment and pleasure and self-care, and during COVID, all three of those things led to constant breakdown and collapse for so many people. And if this teaches us anything, if we can learn anything from that season, is that the tools that we have been given are insufficient. The tools we've been given to carry the load of life do not work. We need a better way to carry the load of life. And this is in the words of the New Testament, we need a better yoke. So what do I mean by yoke? A yoke was a gardening tool in the ancient world. It was a wooden cross pieces that you would put around two oxen, and behind the cross piece was a till that would till the soil. And when you lived in a world that was 100% dependent on like what you can grow and what you can harvest, a yoke was super, super important, because that was the difference between you spending hours just tilling a little bit of land or a whole day tilling the majority of your crops. So a yoke was a tool that was made to shoulder the burden of the workload that you were doing at that time. Does that make sense? So it was a tool that made gardening way easier, but a yoke was also spoken of metaphorically in the ancient world. And I'm sure you guys have heard the term yoke just by reading the Bible and being in church. However long you've been in church, you've probably heard the term yoke a lot. Growing up in ancient Judaism, in the time where Jesus was alive when he was a kid, there was this custom where if you were a Jewish boy in that time, when you came of age, and for them coming of age was about 4 to 5 years old, every single Jewish boy had parents who aspired for those kids to become religious leaders in their community, to be Pharisees and rabbis or Sadducees. Like, there was a hope that these, because in those days, like, the ultimate celebrities, the ultimate influencers of the time was religious leaders. They were the big deals back then. Like nowadays, if I tell people I'm a pastor, like I'm actually kind of sheepish of telling people I'm a pastor, because I get weird looks and people are like, really? You seem so normal. But like, it's like, so it's not the same at all today as what it used to be. Like back in those days, that was the end all be all. Like you wanted to be a pastor. That was the most powerful place of authority and influence you could have in the ancient world. And in the ancient world, all young boys had an opportunity, if their parents wanted, for them to try out for this. So when they came of age at 4 or 5, they would go to their local synagogue and the rabbi would assign them. You have to memorize at 4 or 5 years old. Aaron, how old are you? You're 9? 9. You have to memorize at 4 or 5 years old. 10. Sorry. The first 5 books of the Bible. The whole first 5 books of the Bible. So 5 years younger than that dude right there sitting over there, you have to memorize the entire first 5 books of the Bible. And so as these little kids were reciting it with their parents and they're working with their parents, they would go to their rabbis after, I don't remember the amount of time, after a certain period of time, they would go to their rabbis and the rabbis would sit in front of them and they would ask the kids to recite the first 5 books of the Bible. And if the kids didn't do a good job, or if they forgot a few words, or if they flubbed and had to start over, if it wasn't immaculate, the rabbi would send that kid back home and tell him that you're not cut out for this. And so the kid would then go on to take on their father's trade, which was either a fisherman or a carpenter or a gardener of some sort. After that, if they did recite the 5 books and they did it well, the rabbi would give them another extended period of the Old Testament. Depending on where you live, it could have been the entire Old Testament or it could have been just big chunks of the Old Testament. And you would have to rememorize this over and over and over again. And then you would come back to your rabbi and you would have to recite it. And same thing again. Like if you did it well, you would be able to move on to the next stage in the process. But if you failed, you would have to go back home to take up your parents' trade. Now, something really important to keep in mind. When you're reading the New Testament, there's a really good chance that the majority of the Jewish men that you come across in those stories who are not Pharisees or rabbis are people who were rejected by that system. They're people who were told, you don't cut it. You're not good enough. You do not belong here. So they were the cast aside, the rejected, the left out. If you did do a good job of memorizing all those passages and you recited it to your rabbi's liking, then your rabbi would have you come in for an interview with a whole group of rabbis and they would just grill you on all things theology. They would ask you questions about heaven and the afterlife, and they would ask you questions about how you interpret the Bible what you think pastoring is and what rabbi is and stuff that like any 12 or 13 year old kid is totally prepared to answer. Like, so they would just like grill you, and if the rabbis liked what you were saying, then you would then go on and you would move on. And this was extremely rare, and you would become what they called this rabbi's disciple. Now, in the Greek word disciple is the Greek word mathetes. Everybody say mathetes. Mathetes is translated as disciple or student or pupil or learner, but a lot of scholars argue, and I would agree, that the best way to translate mathetes is the word apprentice. You would then, to apprentice under somebody is to study under somebody who is a master of their craft and learn to take on their way of doing things and mimic it as best as they can so that you too could be a master of that craft. So these people would then become this rabbi's disciples, and they would follow the disciple, and they would copy everything they could about their rabbi. They would learn when they read the scriptures, how they interpreted it, how they applied it, how they loved their family or served their family, how they pastored people, how they went to the bathroom and when they went to the, like, just totally, like, just following them everywhere and just everything they can about their rabbi, taking it on themselves. And they had a metaphor for this, and they would call this taking on your rabbi's yoke. Your rabbi's way of doing things in the world. So their way of shouldering the weight of life. It was a hard and grueling process. Many people sabotaged their families and their livelihood to do this. And if you didn't succeed at this, if you failed, it was a shame that would follow you for the rest of your life. So what makes Jesus such a radical new type of rabbi is that he is the one who intentionally apprentices the outcasts. He's the one who intentionally, nobody in Jesus' discipleship team are people who made it on to the next stage of the program. There's no rabbis in Jesus' discipleship team. It's all people who were fishermen or even worse, tax collectors or zealots. Like, it's all people who were told, you do not cut it. You're not good enough for this. Jesus intentionally went to those people and said, follow me. I'm going to take up my way, take up my yoke, take up my way of doing things. And Jesus was not at all a fan of the way that Pharisees did things. Yet, in fact, he had a really strong word. In Matthew 23, he says that they tie up heavy, cumbersome loads, and they put them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. In other words, he is saying that they put religious demands on people that crushed them. It crushed their sense of self. It made it so that they no longer could view themselves as valuable image bearers of God. The yoke of the Pharisees was placed on these people, and it made them question whether or not God wanted anything to do with them. Now, how many of you guys know, like, it's hard enough already, like, when you feel like an outcast, or you feel like a failure, or you've messed up, it's hard to feel like you have good standing with God. Now, add to it religious leaders who are piling stuff on top of you and making you jump through all of these hoops just so you could have any sense of connection with the divine. They abusively shamed people for not following the religious law that they set when they themselves were not following the religious law that they set. They added rules to scriptures, and they made holiness an impossible task. The yoke of the Pharisees was an exhausting, overbearing, spiritually and emotionally abusive yoke. And Jesus critiques this yoke often, but he also offers a better alternative. In Matthew 11, 27 through 30, it's one of my favorite passages, one of my favorite teachings of Jesus in the whole New Testament. He says, "All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those whom the Son chooses to reveal to them." You get it. So the point is that Jesus is making a very, very big claim. He's saying that God has given all authority to Jesus. That's the first big claim. Okay, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. You don't just walk around saying that in the ancient world. That is a big claim. But the second thing is that Jesus is the one who reveals the Father to people. Now think about in that time, like, what if that's true, if Jesus is the one who reveals the Father to people, then that means your rabbis are not the one who revealed the Father to people. Your spiritual community is not the one who revealed the Father to people. Your shame is not the one that's revealing the Father to you. Jesus is the one who reveals the Father to you. And then Jesus is offering a different yoke. He goes on to say, after that, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me, for I am gentle and humble at heart. And you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." It's a contrast here between the heavy yoke of the Pharisees and the light and easy yoke of Jesus that he gives us. Jesus is offering a different type of yoke, a different way of shouldering the weight of life. The Pharisees' way of doing things, exhausting, arrogant, abusive, full of shame, and heavy to the point of crushing. The way of Jesus is light and easy and humble and gentle and restful. I love the way Eugene Peterson paraphrases this in The Message. This is so beautiful. And in fact, if I could just invite you, just close your eyes and just listen to this. And just hear the invitation of the Spirit in this. Like, I really think there's an invitation from the Holy Spirit to you in this way, in the way Eugene translates this. He says, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? come to me. Get away with me and you will recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. That is the invitation of Jesus. But isn't it interesting? This is fascinating to me. That Jesus' answer to tired, worn-out, burdened people is a tool. It's a yoke. It's a gardening tool. Wouldn't you think if somebody was exhausted and burned out, you would be like, come to my bed and take a rest. Or like, go on a vacation and take a rest. Or like, take a day off and here's a rest. But Jesus doesn't do any of those things. He gives them a tool, which in your mind you might think, well, that's a lot more work. Like a tool, this is an image of work. It's tilling the ground. It's not an image of rest. But what Jesus is saying is that he knows that when you are exhausted to that point of a soul level, you need so much more than just a vacation. Because you come back from that vacation and you dive right back into what things it used to be. You need an entire new way of being human. So Jesus isn't just saying, escape from your problems, forget your problems, move on and go away or disappear or disengage. Jesus is saying, take on a new way of shouldering the weight of your problems. Jesus knows that the root of the problem for the people he is talking to is the way they lived their life. They needed a new way to shoulder the burden of life. And Jesus is offering that here. And can I just say, who doesn't want that? Like, who doesn't want a way of living life that is light and easy and gentle and restful and has full of peace? So back to my pandemic breakdown. After years of doing hard work on my mental health, I was experiencing panic attacks and depression all over again. Why did that happen? I traded the yoke of Jesus for the yoke of the world. I traded the way of Jesus and Jesus' methods of walking through life, and I slipped into our culture's methods of disengagement, distraction, and entertainment. And I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. And so I resolved to realign myself with the way of Jesus, to get back into reading the scriptures and spending time in prayer and taking time to just sit alone and quiet and abide in the presence of God, as Jesus instructs us to do in John 15. And as I was doing those things, I noticed that, like, I was slowly starting to rebuild my internal fortitude. I was less reactive and less anxious and less depressed, and I was kind of holding it together a little bit. But then in September of last year, the COVID death count stopped being a number on my phone screen, and it became real when my mother-in-law was afflicted with COVID. And then when she was put into the ICU, and after 11 days in the ICU, we were told that she was not going to make it, that her organs were shutting down, and that the most humane thing to do at this point was to turn off the machines and let her go in peace. And so I knew, like, when that happened, that I did not want my wife or her sister to have to be in the room when that happened, and I did not want my father-in-law to have to be in there and have that moment all by himself and have to make that walk down from the hospital back out to us in the courtyard. Remember, this is lockdown, so we couldn't all be up in the hospital with her. And so I asked my father-in-law, I said, hey, like, if you don't want to be in there alone for that, like, I will be with you every step of the way of this. Like, you don't have to do any of this by yourself. And my brother-in-law, Ryan, who was up there leading worship, he seconded that notion. He said, yes, me too. We are with you in this if you need us. And so we went up with my father-in-law and got to be in the room with her. And he asked us to stay when they turned off the machine. And we held her hands and we prayed Psalm 23 over her and prayed the Lord's Prayer. And then the nurse nodded her head and let us know that she had passed. And Ryan and I held my father-in-law as he wept, and we made the walk with him back down from the hospital into the courtyard where everybody was waiting. Why do I share this? I share this because there is no part of me that has the internal gumption or the strength or the fortitude to watch someone I love die, especially when no one is asking me to. There's no part of me that wants to do that. But I knew, and Ryan and I talked about this since, we knew in our souls, like, this was something that not just our father-in-law was asking of us, that the Lord was asking of us. That we knew that we were supposed to go up there and be with him during that process. It was by no means easy, but it was bearable. We shouldered that weight, and there was this almost supernatural lifting of the weight that happened with us. When you take on the yoke of Jesus, you find yourself stepping into things you never thought you would be able to do. But you find yourself with the strength to endure, and you find Christ shouldering impossible moments with you. The resources of our world do not equip us for big tasks or standing in the room during unspeakable tragedies. But Jesus has the resources to give us the strength to move through life with His character and with His love and ultimately with His peace. But how do we get there? Where do we even start with any of this? If you're like me, I'm a very practical person. I like to know where to start with this stuff. So I'm going to end with just three things to take home and consider when taking on the yoke of Jesus. The first one I think is the most important one. If you're taking notes, go ahead and write this down. There was a statistic that released that came out recently that says you're like 40% less likely to go to hell if you take notes during a sermon. So if you're taking notes, the first one, I had to cut the tension. The first one is that the yoke of Jesus rejects all other yokes. The yoke of Jesus rejects all other yokes. One of my favorite writers is a guy named Ronald Rollheiser. He says that every yes is a thousand no's. If you're going to say yes to one thing, it's saying no to a whole bunch of other things. And wise people understand this. Wise people get, like, they weigh their yeses and their no's very carefully because they know that every yes is a thousand no's. Jesus becomes our rabbi, and then Jesus leads us to the deepest, truest parts of ourselves. And we can't wear more than one yoke at a time. We have to pick one. And our world assigns yokes to us. And we take them on without even thinking about it. Like, it is a subconscious level where we take on the yoke of the world. The yoke, and they look differently. So one of them can be the yoke of achievement, where we shoulder the weight of life by trying to achieve as much as possible. And our achievement is supposed to mask our internal aches and our longings and our desires and our pain. But after a while, those people who take on the yoke of achievement inevitably burn out and collapse, or they deteriorate the most intimate relationships in their lives. Then there's the yoke of identity curating. We try and form our own identities and hope that it gives us the strength we need. But eventually we exhaust ourselves trying to create a version of ourselves that we think we should be or that we think the world wants us to be. Then there's the yoke of disengagement, which is the one that I've struggled with the most. We check out. We put on our headphones. We zone out. And this was my method, and doing so, as I said, was exhausting. There's the yoke of pleasure, where we just try and shoulder the weight of life by pursuing pleasure, whether it's food or alcohol or sex or drugs. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of my best, greatest theologians of all time, in my opinion, right? Dr. John? Yeah, okay. he said this, "Only the man who follows the command of Jesus single-mindedly and unresistingly lets his yoke rest upon him." Only the man who follows the way of Jesus single-mindedly. This is the only path. Only that person receives the light and easy yoke of Jesus. He says he finds his burdens easy and under its gentle pressure receives the power to persevere in the right way. The command of Jesus is hard, unutterably hard, for those who try and resist it. That's important. So if you're trying to follow Jesus, but you're still resisting some of his stuff, that is not going to feel like a light and easy yoke. But for those who willingly submit, the yoke is easy and the burden is light. To say yes to the yoke of Jesus is to say no to these and many other yokes, but it is also to say yes to the one thing that can actually deliver on its promises to you. It's the one thing that can actually deliver on its promises to give us a light and easy life. The second thing is that the yoke of Jesus starts in our hearts. So, the New Testament writers, the place of transformation, the place of our motivations, the place where all of life flows out of is where? Come on, you guys have been sitting under Dr. John. I know you know this. It comes from our hearts. Like, this is where it's the seat of our motivations. It's where all of life flows out of what comes out of our hearts. And so it requires a renovated heart, in the words of Dallas Willard, in order to be able to actually take on this easy yoke. It starts with us going to Jesus, as Ryan sang up there, in the secret and the quiet place, and allowing the words of Jesus to transform us. True discipleship gives Christ access to our hearts, and it allows him to transform our motivations. Dallas Willard, my favorite writer of all time, he says that the revolution of Jesus is in the first place and continuously a revolution of the human heart. Did you catch that? The revolution of Jesus is first and foremost a revolution of the human heart. It does not proceed by means of formation of social institutions and laws or outer expressions of reality. So it comes from our hearts. It's not about changing systems and realigning the way things work in the world. It starts in our hearts. Rather, this is a revolution of character which proceeds by changing people from the inside out through ongoing personal relationship with God. It is one that changes our ideas, our beliefs, our feelings, our habits of choice, as well as our bodily tendencies and our, the way we relate to one another. It penetrates the deepest layers of the soul. The goal is that our hearts would be motivated by the same things that motivated Christ. That's where the easy yoke starts. It's by going deep down into the stuff that motivates us and transforms us and allows us to have the inner character of Jesus. Lastly, the yoke of Jesus overflows from our hearts to the glory of God and for the benefit of others. I'm going to say that again. The yoke of Jesus overflows from our hearts to the glory of God and for the benefit of others. The yoke of Jesus isn't just for us. This isn't self-help, self-care, or any of that stuff. This is radical discipleship. It's not self-improvement. If our apprentice to Jesus doesn't put a magnifying glass, which is what it means to glorify God, it's literally to hold up a magnifying glass to the beauty and love and goodness of our Creator. If our apprenticeship to Jesus doesn't do that, and it doesn't serve the people around us in just and generous ways, if it doesn't do those things, it is not apprenticeship to Jesus. The yoke of Jesus always seeks radical love and generosity for our neighbors, including our enemies, and the yoke of Jesus always shines light on the love of God and the beauty of the gospel. So it starts in our hearts, but it overflows out of our being. The yoke of Jesus rejects all other yokes. The yoke of Jesus starts in our hearts, and the yoke of Jesus overflows to the glory of God and the benefit of other people. I'm going to pray. Lord, I love you, and I thank you for your light and easy yoke. In fact, I just want to take a moment and just invite people in this room. We're just going to take 1 minute of silence. And just, if you're willing, if you want to, just say, I receive your yoke. I trust your yoke. I'm not going to resist, like Bonhoeffer said, and make this easy yoke an agonizing burden. But I'm just going to willingly submit and trust you, and I'm going to take on your way of shouldering the weight of life. So just 1 minute. So Jesus, we love you. We receive you. We know that this is a process. Transformation is a process. It's not something that happens in an instant. Very rarely is it that. Sometimes it is, but usually it is a long, long process. And so Lord, I pray for those of us in this room, myself included, who are determined to take on your yoke and learn to shoulder the weight of life in the way that you want us to. God, I ask that we would sense the gentle rhythms of your Spirit. As that we would be responsive to your direction and that we would be obedient. And that our hearts would continually be submitted to you, trusting you that you want and know our deepest good. And we love you, Lord, in your name. Amen.